the teacher says you need to go and chat to the head teacher, and it was my mum on the phone. My mum had had a phone call from George Lucas. Literally, it was him. It wasn't his people. It was George Lucas on the phone.
Hello, this is your host, Graham Rooney, and welcome to A Performer, A Pint, and A Pod. The podcast where I take you down the pub and we meet a performer, have a drink, and find out the tiddly truth you only get in a pub. I'll be chatting to fantastic performers at all different points of their careers, discussing where they've come from, career-defining moments, and of course, guilty pleasures. All whilst having a laugh and getting a wee bit pissed. Fancy a pint with a pop star? A whiskey with your West End idol? Or a mojito with a magician? Then join me down the pub. So, without further ado, let's head down to the local and see which one of the nation's top performers is in there tonight. Pint, please, mate. Thank you very much. In the first ever episode of A Performer, A Pint and A Pod, I'm overjoyed to be joined by the fantastic performer, James Robinson, an actor who began his career in the Oscar-winning movie Braveheart, but most recently performed in Macbeth for the National Theatre. James Robinson, welcome to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod. How are you, mate?
Hello, I'm very well, Graham. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, no problem at all, mate. So what are you drinking?
I'm drinking from our homeland. It's a wee cheeky Brewdog Punk IPA.
Oh, Brewdog.
Yeah.
The cultured man's drink from Scotland, unlike Tennent.
Yeah, Tennent's is a low bar. But I do like a cheeky wee Tennent's, it has to be said.
Well, it's dependent on the wallet for me, really. but there we go. I'm on Estrella. Estrella Dam.
Estrella. Is that Spanish?
There is. Barcelona.
That's me showing how cultured I am, isn't it?
No, not really. Not at all. Oh, dear. Right. All right, Jamesy. Well, you are a performer, a top performer, a fantastic performer. You've had an amazing career. I said about some of your credits at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
So without any further ado, let's dive on in. Now, you had a phenomenal start to your professional career.
Yeah.
Without doubt. I mean, it is one of my favourite movies of all time, Braveheart. Please do tell us how that happened. How did it all begin?
The whole Braveheart story. It's really strange looking back at it now, to be honest. It's so long ago. It's now become one of the, like, they call it like a modern day classic. And I mean, I would be like, when I think of classics, I look back at, like, say, like Spartacus or Ben-Hur or like Gone with the Wind or whatever. And they're all like years and years ago. So for people to be talking about it like that, and I'm...
You know what that means, though? It means you're an old fart.
Exactly. I've got to just get to grips with that. But yeah, the Braveheart thing, I'd never acted before at all. Like, even, I mean, obviously, I was 10 years old when I did it. And to say what I think it went on to be, but I'd never acted before, not even in, like, school plays. I think I'd been...
So how did that happen then? How did the actual you becoming... the young William Wallace.
So I, as I say, I'd never acted before. I'd done maybe a third Shepherd from the Right in the Nativity and in school with a tea towel on my head or something like that. But my big cousin was really into acting. He was about, I think he was 14 at the time. And he used to go to, I was brought up in Ayr, in Ayrshire, southwest of Scotland. And he went to Ayr Youth Theatre. Little did we know that one of the tutors, one of the guys that took Ayr Youth Theatre, was called John Murta, a Scottish actor, and he'd just been cast in Braveheart. When he was in his audition and got the part, they'd said they were still looking for a young Mel Gibson, and it was probably like 2 or 3 weeks until we started filming. So it was down to the wire. They'd been all around Scotland, all around England as well, like trying to see if they could find someone. that could do the accent or whatever. They couldn't find anyone. And he said, well, I do this youth theatre in Ayr. Every Saturday, you should come along to the youth theatre. So it's like one thing leading to another. My cousin was at the youth theatre, and the casting directors who were, it was a beautiful lady, Patsy Pollock, who's, I don't think she's in the business anymore, but her young intern at the time was Gina Jay, a casting director.
Right, yeah.
And it was Gina's first ever job, like being a casting associate type thing, casting assistant. And now Gina's went on to do amazing things like the Harry Potters and...
yeah, she's not done bad for herself.
She's not done bad. At least got, I mean, you could... yeah, it goes on forever. And she's a lovely woman as well. So yeah, they came to the theatre, the youth theatre, and they lined up all the lads in a row and were like, yes, maybe, no, 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 no. And then it basically all of them were wrong. And my cousin was a bit ballsy when he was younger, a bit on the front foot. And he put his hand up and said, what are you looking for? And they said, we need someone with dark hair and blue eyes. That was the kind of main stipulation, but also they needed them to be right for the part, just have that little something that they needed for William Wallace. So he said, well, I'll take you around the town and show you where young lads hang out.
What? I'll take the casting directors of Braveheart around yeah. the town.
It would never be done today. Like, basically, they said okay, and he got in the kind of the there was a driver and drove them about town and basically took them to like football pitches, Pizza Hut, like places where lads would hang out. And it was all above board. It wasn't like any kind of dodginess or anything like that. But you think nowadays, you're like,
That's good.
It's always good. It would never be allowed to happen, but I'm glad it did, because my cousin, they took them around to loads of different places. And then he said, wait there, Matt, my cousin has dark hair. I don't know if he's got blue eyes or not. And then they said, we'll give him a phone. So he phoned my house on a Saturday afternoon. I think I was watching TV. I think I was watching like Gladiators or something like that. Like it was like a video or something. You remember Gladiators with Wolf?
Of course. I loved Gladiators. It was like my goal to be on it as a kid.
I used to be in love with Jet when I was younger. She was my first crush, I think. Anyway.
Who wasn't?
So, I think I was watching something like that, and the phone goes, and it's my cousin on the phone to my dad. He says, oh, I've got the casting director for Mel Gibson's new film here wanting to come round and meet James. And my dad's like, aye, all right. Because Andy was a bit of a wind-up. Andy was my cousin's name. And he goes, aye, all right. And then he goes, right, we're going to be round in 15 minutes. And lo and behold, 15 minutes later, Andy pulls up with these kind of quite... And Patsy was I don't know, flamboyant person. So she was like, darling, darling, sweetie, and all this kind of stuff. And like came in, and I remember, I think my mum asked if they wanted a drink or a cup of tea or something like that. And I think Patsy wanted a wine, I think. And she was like, Saturday afternoon, okay, we need to just chatting away to me. It was all a bit kind of strange, but brilliant. And then
just to, like, chuck in here for I would say anyone a bit younger listening to this, the reason I would say why they drove around and turned up at your house, because there'll be people going, well, why didn't they just show the phone with like a picture or something?
Yeah,
because back then no one had mobile phones with pictures. Probably never had a mobile phone on them at that point, they were very wealthy.
1994, so, there was no real mobile phones kicking up. It was landline.
So that was why they had to hunt on foot round here and turn up at your doorstep.
And also, it makes it all the more ridiculous that they even got to me, like got that it actually happened, because it really all fingers were pointing to that not happening. Like, it just so happens my cousin was at Air Youth Theatre or whatever. So we ended up going out, and Andy had an idea that we went down to the River Ayr, because they told us the film was going to be about William Wallace, and Andy knew that there was a place called Wallace's Heel down in the River Ayr where Wallace apparently killed his first Englishman. He killed an Englishman on a horse and jumped off the edge of the bank on the riverbank and made a heel print. It's ridiculous now because there's a plaque there and there's a little hole that says this is Wallace's heel and there's a spring that comes out of it and all that. It's ridiculous. It's tourism to the max. But he thought, oh, we'll go down to the river here and show that. And they took a wee video of me and Andy skimming stones on the river. And that was it. They said they'd be in touch. And the Sunday, the following day, my mum got a phone call saying, do you think James could get the day off school tomorrow, the Monday, to come down to Shepperton Studios to meet Mel Gibson for an interview? And my mum's like, I'm sure that the teacher will sort that out. They'll be able to make that happen. So yeah, I went down following day, flew down to Shepperton Studios, which was amazing. Like a 10-year-old boy, and there was cameras, and there was another film getting filmed across the way.
Shepperton is huge. Yeah. I mean, it does massive films.
It was insane. It didn't seem real. It really didn't. It was like I walked through this big corridor and there was costumes from loads of different movies and glass cases, like showing off like previous movies that they'd shot there and everything. And yeah, they said this was quite indicative to how it went as well. Like I'm really proud of the way my mum and dad dealt with everything. And from the very beginning, my mum was with me the whole way. And they said, do you want to go and meet Mel? And I said, yeah. And my mum said, do you want to go in on your own or do you want me to come in with you? And I said, I'm all right, like going in on my own. They asked whether my mum, and we're fine. It wasn't like a deal or anything like that. And I went in like on my own and we had a chat for like 15 minutes. Mel Gibson doesn't really believe in auditioning actors. He didn't with the adult actors either. He just chats to you for 15 minutes and sees whether you've got, it's unreal. He just has a little in current day. Like I've never had a meeting like it again. And he just chatted about my sister, my family, my dog, like watched a video of us skimming stones. And then he said, yeah, I like you, kid. Do you wanna do the film? And I was like, I think so, yeah. Yeah, like I didn't know what it was at the time.
So like to summarize up to this point, basically your cousin was a bit bolshy at Ayr Youth Theatre.
Yeah.
Dragged them round Ayr.
Yep.
Which brought the casting directors of this Oscar-winning film to you.
Exactly. You got to remember, you then, at the time, we didn't know it was going to be Oscar-winning at all.
No, I know, but then you got taken down the river to skim some stones.
Yep.
Next thing you know, you're down at one of the biggest film studios in the world.
I know.
Meeting, and I mean, in the 90s, Mel Gibson was possibly the biggest star in the world.
Lethal Weapon.
Have a chat with him, and then he says, you know what? Welcome to Hollywood.
Welcome to Hollywood. It wasn't quite Hollywood when we started filming, that's for sure, up in Fort William, but. Yeah, it was. That's pretty much how it went. And my mum, we didn't know. I don't come from an acting family. My mum was working with Ayr United. Like they did this 5-star lottery thing at the time, and my mum did part time hours there. And my dad was a fireman. So like we didn't know any of this world at all. And they said, "Are you happy with everything that's how it's going to go?" And we're like, "Well, we don't know, but." I said I'm happy up to this point, but I said I'm gutted for Andy, my cousin who was skimming stones and all that, and the guy that got me there. I said he got me here, and like he loved.
You took the part.
So Mel himself said, "Is that Andy in the video that you're skimming stones with?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, we've not cast the young Hamish yet, and we need a young Hamish, and so we'll dye his hair red and make him the young Hamish in the film." So it ended up my cousin was in the film as well. So he got me the part and I got him the part in the movie. And I got to share this amazing experience with like still my best mate to this day.
I can't.
You can't.
I also can't believe, as a ginger man myself, that I did not realise the young Hamish had dyed his hair.
Yeah, dyed his hair. No, my mum said Andy had red hair when he was born and it grew out into being darker. So that was kind of the clinch. They were like, oh, well, he's already got red hair. We'll just dye it red and make him Hamish. And do you know what? It was an absolute coup for the film. It meant that the rapport on set, it normalised everything. It meant like, and also it meant when I came out of it, I didn't feel like I needed to, oh, but you don't understand this and that happened and that happened, because my cousin was there and we shared it together. And my mum was also there as well. She ended up being my chaperone. They said they were going to get chaperones for me. And my mum said, no, you're not. If you want my son to be in the film, my mum doesn't mince her words, says, if you want my son to be in this film, you employ me as the chaperone and that's it, or else he's not going to do it. And then fair play to her. She didn't, I think they liked that about my mum. My mum doesn't care about the trappings of Hollywood and how much it's going to cost if you go for a wee and all that kind of stuff. Like it's like what food you're going to get. My mum's like, this is my son. He's going to get treated.
That's it.
Treated the way.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Is that you were her son.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter who she's speaking to. Mm. There's only one person that knows you best.
Yeah.
And knows what's best for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a bit about the filming then, yeah. And just how huge it was and deal, because I mean it was a massive film. Mm-hmm. And like there's obviously loads of extras,
yeah.
Tell us all about it.
It started all very, very quickly, because as I say, we only had a few weeks until we started filming. And then I knew I was going to be taken out of school. So even things like that, being taken out of school, and then I had to have tutoring every day in the kind of Winnebago thing that they provided, like the caravan thing. And the one question people ask now is, do you remember it? And I absolutely remember like most of it, like 70% of everything. And if you ask me about a couple of months when I was 11, 12 years old, I'll never be able to tell you. But there was something about it. You just knew it was going to be one of these huge experiences in my life. And we never, ever knew what kind of impact it was going to have, because there was two films being filmed at the same time, big Scottish films, Braveheart and Rob Roy was being filmed at exactly the same time in Fort William. Incidentally, and so you didn't just have Hollywood coming to Fort William. You had Hollywood times two coming to Fort William. You had Tim Roth and Jessica Lange and Liam Neeson in the same like restaurant as Mel Gibson and Brian Cox and Brendan Gleeson. And see, to be fair, everyone, because it was Michael Caton Jones that directed Rob Roy, and it was seen as Rob Roy was going to be the hit, because on paper, think about it, it's an Australian-American actor who you would think doesn't know anything about Scotland, doing this film about William Wallace, who was apparently 7 feet tall, and then that Mel Gibson's, he's tall, but he's about 5'9", 5'10", or something like that. So, and then you've got Rob Roy, it was directed by a Brit, and Michael Caton Jones, it was a Celtic guy, Liam Neeson, playing a Celt. It had all the trappings of Braveheart. Was the kind of ugly sister of Rob Roy that was going to be the hit, apparently. And it became apparent that we were kind of fighting up against it, because I think all the funding got pulled at one point from Braveheart, from one of the production studios. And Mel Gibson, to his absolute positive, he put his own money into it. That's when he became one of the producers and basically made it a personal mission for him to get this film made and be kind of done in the best way possible. And
well, I think he did right, didn't he?
Well, that's the thing. It's do you know, I can't really everyone talks about Mel Gibson obviously just now, and his press he's had in the years past, and I can only speak about the Mel Gibson that I knew. And he was charismatic, he was generous, he was kind, he was selfless to a fault, like, because he was directing it as well, acting in it, producing it. He was being pulled every which way, and I think he was getting like 4 hours sleep he'd be doing, because after filming he'd be going and watching the rushes, then he'd have to speak to Americans on their time and all that kind of stuff. So, and even then, when he's put hundreds, like tens of millions of his money into it. Like, I remember he, like, when there was loads of extras on set one day, like 1,000 extras or something, he was waiting in the queue for catering. And his assistant went up and said, look, you don't need to do this. You jump the queue, we can. And he says, no. I'm waiting in the queue with these guys. These guys have worked just as hard, if not harder than me. I'll wait with them. They deserve, like, he waited in the queue.
Fair play.
And I kind of went, well, that's the kind of measure of the man for me, like, that I knew. Obviously, I can't talk about what's happened after or whatever, but it's, I just remember, and I don't think anyone on that set would have a bad word to say about the guy, because...
Well, that's it, yeah. No, and definitely, I think who you worked with and what he did there, by the sounds of things, makes him sound like he was a fantastic person to work with.
Yeah. Being on set, in his direction, especially with kids, and I think he had 6 kids at the time, and he's got more now, but he definitely knew... like just what he could get and how and like how to treat children with respect. And because I was there and they were trying to get me, I think there was the funeral scene where I cry and the tear comes down and all that, and they were desperate to get this shot and I couldn't cry, to be fair. They put like tear stick and all that kind of stuff. They wanted it to be kind of genuine as well. They didn't want it just to be a tear rolling down with no emotion behind it. So
yeah.
Mel said, there's bodies of my dad and my brother in the film. And he said, look, do you mind playing a bit of make-believe? Like, whatever, you're Stanislavski and like, imagine this is that and that is that and all that. Sense memory and everything. He says, imagine this is your dad, your own dad. But it's not really in real life, but imagine how sad you would feel. And then we did a take. And it just didn't read. And he said, and the assistant director comes up and says, get more tear stick on. And Mel's like, no. And he said, what did you feel there? And I said, I can't put myself in that situation. I couldn't. I just said, I remember saying, I can't imagine that. I really couldn't imagine my own dad lying there. And then he says, has anything sad happened in your life? And I said, yeah, my dog has just died. And then, like, about 6 months before, and he says, if it's not, I mean, he was like, I mean, if it's too much to think about, don't do it. But instead of your dad, imagine that it's your dog Tara there or whatever. And then, like, the next take was like, bang, like, tears. It was my dad talking.
And there you go. It's your dad down there. Nothing. No. It's your dog down there. Exactly. Tears.
Exactly.
Your dad listening to this is going to be happy, isn't he?
I think it was because it was so far removed. I've never had anyone pass away apart from my dog. So he'll probably be happy, the fact that I couldn't imagine it. But I think, and also, like, I actually did a dissertation when I went to drama school on method acting, and I mentioned that story, and it's like, I don't feel like it was taking advantage or, oh my God, that's exploitation of whatever. I think it was just like checking what the boundaries were, and he got the result he needed. And then afterwards he was like, it's all right. And he got me to chat about my dog in a happy way. He was like, oh, so what did you like doing with the dog? And I was looked after in that way. And it wasn't like, let's just exploit him, get him upset and then shift him off.
No, really. No, definitely not. I mean, listening to you, and listening to the story you've told, it sounds like, you know, a big Hollywood guy got what he wanted and then left, basically.
Exactly.
Got the money.
Yeah. There's another one.
What's that? Your dog's died. Cry boy. Roll the cameras.
Yeah, go cry. Get it. He's upset. He's emotionally traumatized. Come on. I think there was just every day there was different kind of exciting things that you were doing, and I got to watch some of the battle scenes, and there was real kind of buzz about the place. And then you had like people like,
I put this a little bit in context again for like people who are a bit younger as well and stuff like that who might be listening to this. I suppose it's like The Rock turning up. Like, in a little village,
yeah,
and just taking someone from that house plot to house be in his movie. Big next action movie.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes. It's like...
Mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing.
It was like being... Yeah. Like in it was so exciting. It really was. Like even there was people coming on set. Even people that went in the movie wanted to be there and visiting the set and stuff. I remember Robert the Bruce, Angus McFadden, the guy that was playing Robert the Bruce, he was going out with Catherine Zeta-Jones at the time, and she was on set quite a bit, like sitting around. And she, I think there was one point where, like, she was like, come on, James, come on. And I was sitting in Catherine Zeta-Jones's knee, right? And she was chatting away. And obviously you had Sophie Marceau, Catherine McCormack, all these like beautiful women, and my cousin's big brother, like his big sister's husband, was on set the day that I was sitting on Catherine Zeta-Jones's knee, and I was like, he was like, this is, he goes, you don't know how lucky you are. And I was like, yeah, she's awesome. Catherine McCormack's great. Sophie Marceau, one of the beauties of our time. Yeah, she's cool.
You're just sitting on the knee.
Yeah, but
unbelievable.
I remember just seeing, and all these guys, it was exciting for everyone. You look at the cast and look at what they did before. You had established actors, Patrick McGoohan, like Prisoner, who's Edward Longshanks. But real, it was really like Ian Bannon playing the leper, and Robert Bruce's dad, and established like Brian Cox playing my Uncle Argyle, and that was amazing to be able to do a scene with him. And then you had these actors like Dave O'Hara, Brendan Gleeson, Tommy Flanagan, all these guys that have went on, like Tommy's went on to do like Sons of Anarchy, and he did Gladiator after it, and Brendan Gleeson's become absolutely huge, and obviously Dave O'Hara has done The Wanted and all that kind of thing, but this was a lot of their first big experience on it. Peter Mullen was basically, he had a few lines in the battle scenes, and it was Hollywood's come to Scotland, and it was you felt really proud being a part of it, even
and right, you know, and rightly so, no, without doubt, mate. I think like you say, there is so, when you watch that film,
yeah,
there is so many faces everywhere just shouting a line here, a line there. It is phenomenal. Yeah. And you do then sort of, you'll have watched a Netflix series or whatever. Yeah. And I mean, even right now, Succession, yeah. Brian Cox, leading man.
Yeah.
These sort of things are on.
For that, didn't
he? I did not know that. Did he
win the best actor of the Golden Globe? Brian has.
Well, there we go. Well, you wouldn't know. You're his buddy, you know.
Uncle Argyle.
Talking about awards, it did win Best Film at the Oscars, didn't it?
Yeah. It was nominated for 10 and it won 5, so it was pretty good going. 1 out of 2. It's good.
And did you tour the world at all? Did you go to any of these any of these ceremonies, anything like that?
I didn't tour the world. It was strange because I was 10 years old, like, and when it came out, there was a big hoo-ha because it was a 15. The film was a 15, so there was a big hoo-ha because the premiere, the world premiere was happening. The European premiere in Stirling at Stirling Castle, and we weren't going to get invited because the film was 15. We were too young.
It's too old, to watch yourself.
Yeah, too young to watch myself in the film. Like I was, and that was fine. But I think the newspapers, Scottish newspapers, did a kind of couple of articles on it, and it was getting bad press because me and Andy weren't getting there. Now it wasn't anything to do with us, but I think they went, oh wait, there, we'll get them along type thing. So that was the thing. There was a thing where all the older actors ended up going to the LA premiere, the BAFTAs, the Oscars, all that stuff. But because I was 10, it wasn't a thing really. So I mean, that's something that's neither here nor there. I've never really thought about it, to be honest, in the way of going, oh, I wish I'd have been able to go there. But the world premiere was amazing at Stirling Castle. It was incredible. Like you had the who's who of everyone was there, like Ally McCoist and Gavin Hastings, and of like Scottish Hoi Polloi or whatever. Like, he had, like,
you know, Lorraine I Kelly. Ali McCoist. Ali McCoist was literally on TalkSport talking about that a couple of weeks ago. Uh-huh. And he said, the film finished. And he goes, I'm not joking. I was in the car heading to the border to pick a fight. I was like, I'm on my way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. There was a thing that happened during the premiere that the projector broke in the middle. It stopped. And I remember Mel Robson going out and doing this big speech. And we were sitting next to the door that, like, the projection stuff was happening. And I saw one of the producers going in and going, wow, what the fuck is going on here? Going mental. Like, we need to, because this was huge. You had people from all the production companies in the world. It's crazy. But do you know what was brilliant about it? I was 10 years old and nothing fazed me at all. I was like, I was naive to anything that was going on in the background or any of the stakes. All it was me playing make-believe in the middle of a field where there's a couple of huge cameras. And there's, like, obviously the crew was like, there was 200 people or whatever, but I really never got phased. It's the least phased I've ever. That afterwards, I've been way more self-conscious and knowledgeable about what's happening and the stakes and everything. Back then, it was pure naivety, and it was brilliant. It was beautiful. It was definitely one of the best experiences of my life, and I'll never forget it. It's so proud of being.
Well, I am not surprised at all, mate. And, like, you know, when I first met you and stuff, and I was like, that probably that classic thing you get all the time. I remember looking at your face, and there's so many with actors, we think, oh, do I know him through this or know him through that? And I thought, with your face, I was like, I feel as though I kind of know that face. And it basically was, because I knew that it was like the 10-year-old face growing up to about 20, mid-20s or something when I first ever met you.
Well, I get that. I still get that quite a lot, to be fair. Not people going, oh, I know you from this. But a lot of people say, you've got a really familiar face. And in my head, I'm going, have I met them before? Or is it just because it's this kind of nostalgia of their youth of watching Braveheart or whatever? But that's the thing nowadays as well, people. When people approach me about it, it's actually quite nice. Like I said at the beginning, it's like a modern day classic, inverted commas now. And you've got people that there was a point where everyone had seen Braveheart, but now you've got, it is one of these things that maybe if you're 16, 17, younger, you've never seen the film before. And actually it's not a big deal. Like, people, my friends used to go about, like, at a point and they'd be introducing me, oh, do you know he was the young William Wallace in Braveheart, which I didn't particularly enjoy, but I was used as their kind of meal ticket to getting different bits and bobs and getting free tickets for the cinema or something like that. And then it was like, but now people, and everyone would be like, oh my god, Braveheart, amazing. But now it's quite nice as well, because people don't know it. People, it sounds mental, but people don't actually know it. Young people especially, they'd be like, oh, Braveheart, I've never heard of it, or I've never seen it.
Well, definitely what I will say is, if you have not seen it, if you're listening to this and you have not seen Braveheart, go and watch it. It's brilliant. It is such a good film, Oscar-winning film, and rightly so.
I think that even if I wasn't in it, it would be one of my favourite films, definitely.
And you don't even, it's not even the fact that us two are obviously sitting here Scottish and saying it.
Yeah.
But I've got loads of English mates, and the English are obviously made out to be terrible people, because they are.
No, you can't say that.
Well, I can. Yeah. What they say about us in the film.
I know.
I mean, seriously.
The trouble with Scotland is that it's full of Scots.
Yes. The trouble with Scotland.
Yeah, it's worldwide. It's the one thing that I've done that really, really, it's world renowned in the way of, I was in LA once chatting to two Australian guys in a bar. We were watching the football, and they were like, the minute you're Scottish, people bring up Braveheart as a thing. They go, oh, Scotland, oh, Braveheart is one of my favourite films. Even not knowing that I was in the film, they associate being Scottish with Braveheart. And it's had its...
Well, then that's what they think, like, that's what Scottish people are.
Yeah,
that
where's is your what kilt? They're... Why are you not covered in mud?
Yeah, without doubt, they expect a kill. And at the same time, though, like, you know, Americans come over to Scotland and they're like, right, okay, we expect castles and, oh, wait a minute, there is castles out there.
Yeah.
So we are kind of what is in that film at the same time as well, because there is a lot of hatred towards English as well.
As Scottish, they love the stereotypes as well. Like, people take them, like, Scotland pretends they don't, but we play up to the best stereotypes a lot, and tartan shortbread and loving a bit of whiskey and all that kind of stuff. And we love it. We love it, man, really. But I don't...
I'd just like to put out there, just to let you know, for all those English listeners, I don't hate the English. Please do keep listening to A Performer, A Pint and a Pod.
I can just hear your theme music going... Dee-lee-lee-lee. Yeah.
Anyway, right. Well, you know what? I think that what's amazing is with you is it's kind of like, I feel, is you've almost had two careers.
Yeah.
Braveheart was this phenomenal, huge thing.
Yeah.
That shoved you into the limelight.
Yeah.
And then you kind of went through the full proper procedure of coming into being a professional actor the way that, like, most of us have, kind of thing, you know?
The hard way, yeah, I did. The hard way.
But because a lot of people could look and sort of like look at your CV or whatever and go, oh, well, of course he's done this and this because he was in Braveheart when he was 10. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, you went to one of the top drama schools in the country at Rose Bruford.
Yep.
And, like, you know, you've done many, many a thing, but I'd like to jump now. So we've done Hollywood, which is world-renowned. Let's go to the other place you've been, world-renowned.
Yes.
The National Theatre.
The National Theatre. Yes. Yeah.
And once again, extremely Scottish, of which you were in Macbeth. How was that?
Yeah, I mean, that was very recently as well. It was just 2018 that that happened. So, skipping a big chunk. It ended up that, I'll go straight to Macbeth rather than telling you the journey there. But
before you tell me about Macbeth, tell me what occurred on the sort of, I don't know, 6 months maybe? The 6 months lead up to you getting the part of Macbeth in your career.
All right, yeah. So, basically with with Macbeth, I'd been with an agent for a little while and I'd been working, but I decided it was time that I needed to change. So I decided to represent myself for a time. It sounds crazy.
No, but this is like, obviously I know you well. And I mind you telling me this story because you were with a very good agent. Like, we've all been there, we've been with very good agents, and for some reason it's just not happening. And loads of time I hear these stories of actors, they write off to millions of other agents while they're still with that agent and they try and move and stuff like that. You were a bit different.
I was, yeah. And it may be seen as, I don't know, a misstep or whatever, but I still feel I did the right thing. I always compare, because an agent, being with an agent, it's like being, for me, it's like a relationship between you and your agent. You have to trust each other. You have to respect each other and you have to want to do well for each other. And I would never try and get into a new relationship when I'm with someone else, and it's like, it's the same thing, it's a respect thing. You go, look, this isn't working, let's stop it, and then I can freely look for another agent, look for another avenue. And it's and also it made me much more comfortable approaching other agencies, because I wasn't kind of saying, look, if you can you just keep this quiet because I don't want my agent to find out I'm trying to find another agent, all that kind of, it just seems a bit seedy to me.
And that is so commendable from your part, because basically then what you did was you just, without any other agents, so without any other support in the industry, and knowing that you were just basically going to leave yourself out there with nothing, and that's a very, very, very scary thing to do. You just went in to your agent and said, I think we should part
ways. I went in with that. I get quite emotional. I don't know if you've ever had to leave an agent, Graham, but it's like I get quite kind of a lump in my throat when I'm going in because I see an agency, when you sign with an agent, I see it full of promise and excitement and wow, what can the future hold? And when you leave that agency, it's never been on bad terms for me. I'm still in good talking terms with all agents.
So I just want to clarify a thing here. You get emotional leaving your agent. Emotional about your dog dying, but if your dad is in a grave, nothing.
Now my dad is going to be annoyed when he listens to this podcast. Cheers, mate. Thank you very much. No, what can I say, Graham? I'm a really emotional person. So I went in with a bottle of champagne, some flowers and chocolates, and my agent did the whole thing of, you're leaving us, aren't you? And I said, yeah. The first thing he said was, who are you moving to? And I said, no one. I haven't sent anything to anyone yet. And then they said, that's even worse. You'd rather have no agent than have us at all. Like, oh, it's not like that. And then I explained to them, they wish me all the best in the future. And they said, normally when people come in to leave them, they'd terminate it immediately, like the contract. And I didn't have a contract. It was a verbal thing. And they said, because you've been so respectful and because we like you so much, we're going to still represent you for a month.
I mean, that it's like, in fairness, like that is brilliant. But like, I think, like, you know, there's a lot of fantastic agents out there and they are really nice people. And like, when you're genuine like that, that's brilliant. Yeah. But what's even better is then after throwing yourself into the wilderness, instead of going and getting another agent straight away or doing anything like that, you went and got a job at the National Theatre.
So I'd been trying to produce my own film at the time, trying to be proactive. Well, I did produce my own short film with my good friend, Danny Zam. We did, and we were having meetings at the National because he was rehearsing for a Network with Bryan Cranston. I remember going into the Olivier, and they were building the set for Macbeth, and I kind of looked up online and I looked at the cast list, and it was my friend, my great friend Nick Karimi, who I'd went to Rose Bruford with. So he was playing Lennox, and the Rory Kinnear and Anne-Marie Duff National version of Macbeth, and he was understudying Macbeth. So I phoned him. I was like, the set looks amazing. I need to see this show when it happens. I always love supporting my mates when they're in shows as well. It's just some of the proudest moments I've ever had, are seeing my friends on stage, you included, Mr. Rooney.
Oh, thank you very much.
The West End version of Play That Goes Wrong. So I said, if you go on as Macbeth, give me a shout, because I'd seen him as Lennox. Lo and behold, a month later, I think Rory Kinnear hurt his back, and Nick had to go on for 8 performances. So then I went to the show and watched him, and there's a one point where he does a monologue and the lights just zoom in on him, and the Olivier, this huge monster of a stage and a monster show, playing Macbeth, my best mate from drama school. I'm going to say it, Graham. I got a tear in my eye, I have to say. I got a wee tear in my eye.
Should we just add that to your list then, eh? Add that to the list. How does your dad feel now?
I know.
Seeing your best mate, watching your best mate do a bit of acting makes you cry. But your dad in a grave, nothing.
I don't cry at shows. I cry at films, actually, but I don't cry at shows. I don't know what it is. But anyway, he was playing Macbeth, and it was a really proud moment. Afterwards, he had me up for drinks in the green room, and we were chatting away in the balcony, and he said, how's it going? Have you been seen for the Macbeth tour, 9-month tour of the same show? And I was like, no. And he goes, you need to get your agent on it. And I was like, I've actually just left my agent about a month ago, and I'm representing myself. And he was like, what? He goes, right. He goes, okay. He goes, do you mind if I put your name forward? I said, mate, it'd be incredible. And And that's not to say that it was, oh, you're Nick's friend, you've got this part.
Never. No, of course not, mate. Look, I've been recommended many a time and they did not like me. So
so hard on yourself, Graham.
You should check out this Graham Rooney. Then I walk in, they go, not a chance. Don't waste my time again, boy.
Stop
Get
so
out.
Stop being so modest. I had my first meeting. Originally, it was Liz Stevenson, who was the assistant director. And then I got my next meeting, and it was with Rufus Norris, the artistic director of the National. And sometimes these meetings come along and they're very daunting. And it wasn't at all. It felt like we were really bouncing off each other with ideas, and I didn't feel overawed.
So yeah, so you got the part as Lennox, mm-hmm. and you were cover Macbeth yeah. as well, exactly the same as your mate. Yeah. And obviously, I mean, like it's a dream, like you know, for like loads of people that are actors, like from all around the world, mm-hmm. they dream to work at the National Theatre.
Yeah. For me, I came out of drama school and I thought I've got 5 to 10 companies that I'm desperate to work for, and the National was the top. For me, I always say I got a job at the National Theatre of Scotland, and I always said that was like representing my country. If I was, again, a footballer or a rugby player or whatever.
You're just bringing that up because I auditioned for the same role.
We were both.
You're literally bringing up a part that you got over me
yeah.
on my podcast.
Sorry, mate. We were at the same audition, but there's been plenty that we've been to that you've got as well.
I mean, that is out of order.
Come on.
I'm going to edit that out.
I feel like I had to just drop it in somewhere. Had to, that part that I got. No, I always said that when I got that part at the National Theatre of Scotland, that it was like representing my country for football, like playing for Scotland. And then when I got the part in the National, it's that next level. It's say like being in the British Lions or something like that. It was the next level. It was
from football to rugby.
Yeah. Always like an analogy, like the analogy of a girlfriend that is an agent and all that kind of stuff. But the best feeling you can ever get, one of the best feelings in the industry is when you get offered a part. But then from elation comes the kind of impending dread of going, I've got to do this now. You know what I mean? I've got to. They think I'm the best out of hundreds of actors that they've auditioned. I'm like, then the pressure goes, I've got to remember.
I was a 5-minute fraud. I just had a wonderful 5 minutes and they don't
I
know
really
it.
I really fluked that audition. Now how the hell am I going to remember 750 lines of Shakespeare?
Well, that is the thing, because you were obviously doing Lennox, but you were cover Macbeth well. And for me, look, I have never been a cover, and people doing that, I think it is an amazing thing, because you go on every mm-hmm. night playing mm-hmm. a role, and in the back of your head, you've got another role. You've got another character that's on stage that, like, you know, if something happens, You're the one who's going to be stepping on, like you know that you're the one who's going to be like on stage.
Yeah, when you're on stage doing, for example, Lennox, it's at the very back of your head, the Macbeth stuff, because you're already on. Unless something really bad happens actually on stage, you can almost guarantee you're not going on for that night. But it's I'd never have since or before understudied either. That was a thing as well, because being cover Macbeth, it's a huge undertaking. So you work out that, well, I worked out, I had to remember the most lines of anyone in the show, because Macbeth has the most lines in the show, and then I'm also doing Lennox on top of that. The only other guy that has to remember Macbeth is Macbeth, who is Michael Nardone, brilliant actor and a great friend now, Michael.
Was there any point that you did have to go on as Macbeth?
Yeah, there was, and it was the week before this happened. Okay, to put it into context, the cast, God bless them, had thought it'd be really funny to play a prank on me that I was going on as Macbeth, right? So they'd come up the before, and actually, Michael had been run over by a car. believe it or not. And it's only funny because he survived, right? But is he'd been run over by a car. And if you know Michael, he's an absolute ox. Like, he nothing stops him. And he was like, I'm all right. No bother. Let's do it. Let's go. And I was like, because I initially thought, is this the time when I'm going to be going on? So I got a little bit nervous. People could tell I was a bit preoccupied, thinking, oh God, what if he collapses on stage or whatever and I have to go on? So I was thinking about it a lot. And I think people had clocked onto that and they'd said, let's do James over a wee bit. And I was in, which I saw the light side at the end, but I was pretty pissed off about it afterwards. Yeah, about 5 minutes before they'd said, and they'd been saying all day, I think Michael might be having a break tonight, just to let you know, and blah, blah, blah. Like, everyone in the cast, it was, and crew as well, they were all in on it. So this was, and then it turns out I didn't go on. But yeah, a few weeks later, we're sitting, and there'd been a blade switch on the swords that there's a big fight scene between Macduff and Macbeth at the end. So they'd swapped these blades in, but they were an inch bigger than the previous. And that was a problem because that's when you've been doing a show for, at that point, I think it was 8 months we've been doing the show, and the distances had become so precise between those two. They were so in sync with each other that an inch makes a huge difference.
So I've been told.
So it does. It makes a huge difference. And they were doing the warm-up for the fight one night, and it was 20 minutes to go. And I was watching the fight, and Michael's hand got hit by the sword when they were rehearsing it. And he was raging, to be fair, and rightly so, because it was because the blade had only been brought out about little margins that the blade had been changed so quickly and all this kind of idea. And they said, the company manager, Shan, come up to me and said, you don't need to worry because we can't put you on now. There's 20 minutes to go. So it would be too dangerous because that the implications of that would mean that my understudy, Hawk, would have to go on as Lennox. And then we were already one witch down, and a doctor was off that night, the guy that played the doctor.
This would only happen in the acting world. We're already one witch down.
We already had on the sidelines. So yeah, it was kind of deemed to be that if it happened, if I had to go on, I wouldn't be going on. So they said, don't worry, but just make sure you mark the fight with a new blade just in case. And I was like, okay. I was like, that's weird. If you think I'm not going on, why am I? Okay, I'll start marking it. And I'm marking it. And then Shan came through and said, James, can you come down, have a chat? And she just put her hands on my shoulders and said, you're going on. You're going on as Macbeth. And I was like,
And exactly how long was this before the show was about to start?
Talking 20 minutes, maybe even less, maybe 18 minutes to go until curtain up.
So the audience are rumbling.
I could hear the audience because they put the iron down, which they never did, because normally we'd be shoved off the stage about 10 past, quarter past, and then the audience would come in. But then they said, put the iron in immediately. And give James everything he wants, anything he wants, any scene he wants to go through, any fight, any this, any that. Because, and then they said, this made me laugh. They said, we're opening 5 minutes later to give you a bit of a chance to.
5 minutes to go over Macbeth. Fantastic.
Honestly, I'm nervous just talking about it just now. So she put her hands on my shoulder, and apparently the colour went from my face immediately. And she says, what do you need? And I was like, I need the toilet. and I didn't, like, I didn't actually need the toilet. What I did was I went into the toilet and went in the mirror, sink, splashed my face with cold water, and I was like, right, and I had a wee chat to myself. I had a wee chat going, look, this is what you've been preparing for and all that. And that week, every Sunday in my day off, I'd run all of Macbeth's lines, which actually, to put it into context, like running it as quickly as you possibly can. Like if it were done, it's done, it were well, it were done quickly, if it were blah, blah, blah. Like that pace and missing out everyone else's lines and just doing my lines, it took over an hour and a half to say all Macbeth's lines. So when you get told 18 minutes to go, what preparation do you need? I go, well, I'm not going to go over the lines because it takes an hour and a half to bloody go over the lines. Like, But in my head, I was also thinking, is this a wind-up again? Like, is this a really elaborate wind-up? Oh, come on, you're just having a laugh, aren't you? This is a joke.
So basically, you get told, the audience are coming in,
yeah. And
you get told one of the biggest parts, right? I mean, Macbeth is a massive, massive part. There's so many lines. You dominate the stage. It is all on you. You carry it.
Absolutely.
And like, so you're told that as the audience are coming in, it's 8 months into now. Usually, like when it's like, I've like done a lot of like long runs and stuff like that, and what happens, like you say, the covers relax, and also the rehearsals for cover runs, understudy runs, like are just not like. So when was the last time you had actually fully run it as Macbeth?
On a stage as Macbeth, I'd only done it once, and it was November.
So you'd done it was
November.
Once.
We had an understudy run in November, and this was now March, and it was actually a really positive thing in the way of I knew I was going to have a full crack at it. I was going to have a crack at one of the biggest parts in Shakespeare on a national stage with all the bells and whistles, with all the, because even in the understudy run, there was no blood. We had house lights. There wasn't actual spotlights. Some of the actors had the book in hand who didn't play that part, but they were filling in or whatever. And it felt great to do that in the November.
Yeah, and look, I mean, as well, thinking about it, like you say, it was the national, it's the cream of the crop. You've got this chance to do Macbeth in front of 1,500 people, and if you fanny it up, it's the end of your career. You know, but it's good that you didn't think about it like that.
I'm glad I didn't go in with that mentality, but...
If only I'd been there.
If you'd been there to wind me up beforehand, it might have been a different story. But the thing was that there was a point I remember being really, I remember walking on to the first line. Patrick Robinson was playing Banquo, brilliant actor, and he was looking at me. And the first line, so foul and fair a day I have not seen. And I walked onto the bridge and I see the audience, all these heads out there, 1,500 people to 2,000. It was the Southampton Mayflower, an absolute beast of a venue. And then...
Oh, that's
huge.
Yeah, I know,
and it was full. It was absolutely full. And it's the closest, doing that Macbeth show was the closest, you know, me and how, like, being a pop star or whatever, like, it was the closest you would get to actually having that, like, going on is Take That or something. Because there was people screaming. When the lights go down, people are like, "Wah!" Yeah, like kids, there was loads of school kids in and screaming and all that. And I was going, oh, my God, I am bricking it. But anyway, I walked on and... Patrick's just looking at me and I'm going, oh, that's right. That's my first line. And there was like a moment where I'm going, if I'm struggling for the first line, how's the other 700 going to go? Like,
I sometimes think though, like any time, like, you know, when I've done a first preview and it's been a really big part or something, you know yourself, that first line is almost like jumping up, like it's jumping off the cliff. As soon as you open your mouth and start, that's it, you're away. There's no choice, no turning back.
You're on your own, and it's like, but there was a point in the understudy run in November where I got to a speech, and I was nervous when I did it in November, but I was confident. But it was a small audience. I had friends there and stuff. And I remember getting to the first big speech of Macbeth, and it's Two Truths Are Told. It's the speech that I got emotional when my mate went on, because all the lights go into you and all that stuff. And I remember getting to that speech and I thought, if I don't enjoy this, I'm going to regret it. It's now or never. Just enjoy it. It was the understudy run. It wasn't an audience, really. And I thought that was the speech that I went, boom, this is the time. And I didn't look back from then. And I thought, when I went on, actually, in the actual production, I thought, it's okay. Once I get to this speech, I'll be fine, because that's my moment. That's the point where I relax. And I got to the speech and I went, nope, I still feel in my head here. I still feel like I'm being Macbeth on the national, like, and I was just like, I couldn't settle. And the cast and crew were unbelievable. And then I remember there was a bit when everyone pauses, and it's a bit with a banquet, and there's a soliloquy that Macbeth does towards Duncan. And it's, if it were done when it is done, then it were well it were done quickly. And he talks about how he's going to basically assassinate Duncan. And And I sat on the, everyone pauses and it goes shoom, and there's a silence. And you're meant to go in maybe like straight in when the silence happens. And I took a couple of seconds, which felt like an hour, but it was only literally a couple of breaths. And I sat on the table and the light came on me and I looked out. And it sounds really cheesy, but I could feel everyone in the freeze, like giving me their, sounds wanky, giving me their energy, giving me their, because they were going, I could feel them going, come on, James, you can do this. And
I can only apologize for James Robinson's wankiness in that last comment.
Exactly, it doesn't sound wanky, but I sat and I took an extra 2 seconds. I took a few breaths and I went, I enjoy it, just enjoy it. You know what you're doing.
I think that's a big thing with anyone, is that sometimes you can get so, like, people can get caught up in the worrying of what could go wrong, and everyone has moments in their career and stuff, and you just have to say to yourself, I'm doing this because I love it, I enjoy it, it's a laugh. Like, you know, that's actually, you know, as far as I, like, you know, when people ask me about acting, they ask about what work you got, and I always like, I'm like, it's not work for me. It's like a paid hobby.
I skip to work every day when I've got an acting job. It's incredible. Like,
it's so much fun without.
So that was that. Yeah, it was again one of.
Well, that was that. You know, I mean, that was that. You did Macbeth, like, you know, in one of the biggest theatres in the UK. For the National Theatre Company. Yeah. I mean,
what it does do is it makes you believe that you're capable of stuff like that. And also having constantly had to, I don't know, like I've never, it's not a thing anymore, like the Braveheart thing, but sometimes you go, at the beginning of my career, definitely, I thought, can I do this? Am I just someone that's kind of done one job 20 years, 14 years ago? And I'm trying to blag acting. And there's always that element that you feel that you're doing that. But after coming off that stage, it really made me feel, I was proud of myself, to be honest.
Well, look, that's the thing. And I know what you mean, obviously, about that sort of thing of having Braveheart. It was a huge thing. And to try and match up and to like feel almost like you're reaching for that again, that's like, you know, it's an Oscar-winning film. So it's a very, very difficult thing to do. But I mean, you've had some fantastic jobs since you've been an adult, since you've become a full-time professional actor. I mean, at this moment in time, I believe we can see you on the History Channel.
Yeah.
Is that right? As Washington.
Yeah, it was a TV series. One of the first, definitely the biggest part I've had in a kind of American style TV series. I had a small part in Outlander, but it was definitely a thing of scale, Washington. And when I got there, I was like, it felt like I was getting to do the battle scenes that I never got to do when I was a kid, because I was I'm playing Alexander Hamilton, one of the Hamilton fame of the show. Like, I'm not rapping or singing or dancing. So,
well, I mean. We should just pause actually about Washington at the moment.
It's
you did audition for Hamilton, didn't you?
Oh no, I forced an audition for Hamilton. They did not want to pick up what I was putting down, but I most definitely put it in front of their ocular balls.
I'm sure, I'm pretty positive actually. Like, look, quick tangent here. James Robinson lives on a boat. Okay, he lives on a boat. It's an amazing little thing, in the middle of London. And I remember you showing me. I think it was like, was it an audition video you'd sent?
I forced an audition for it basically, and they said, "Look, you're Scottish. You're not the demographic that we're looking for. You've never done a musical in your life, but." Feel free, send it across. I think they needed a little bit of light relief at lunchtime or something like that. So yeah, I forced an audition. So they said, tape yourself doing a rap song of your choice.
But you got to commend that drive. like you know where the people say just shoot for the stars, do what you want to do it. A lot of people don't. Well, you rapped on a boat.
Yeah.
For the biggest musical in America, when you'd never done a musical in Britain.
I'd done one small musical. I was lying earlier on. It was a small production at the Park Theatre, but I've not done any sort of bona fide musicals. I'm more of a karaoke guy, Graham.
Well, I mean, no. Like, you put yourself down here. I saw that musical, and you have got a very good voice. You do have a very good voice. And also, I mean, let's also not lie. I mean, on the boat, we have karaoke'd on your boat.
There's been some karaoke evenings, shall we say, where we have a few jars and sing songs to the under the stars in the boat. It's very romantic. But
there you go. I mean, so basically you've got William Wallace and Braveheart, you've got Macbeth for the National, and you've got Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me on a canal boat.
But who's George Michael? That's the question. Everyone wants to be George.
That's me.
When I went for the audition for Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton and the History Channel thing, I went for a different part. It was Colonel Patterson, who had like a scene or two with Washington, the lead role. And I went for that part and I got cast as that part. And the director, Roel Rennie, said he said that the part was getting cut basically before it had even started. They said it's surplus or whatever, and it was going to get cut down to a smaller scene. And Roel, I commend him entirely. It's because of him that I got the part that I did, that he said, no, I don't want James. I like James, and I don't want his part to be cut even more. What other parts haven't been cast? And they said Alexander Hamilton, one of the leads in the TV series. And he says, right, well, James is going to play Hamilton then, without an audition, without anything, just on the previous auditions that I'd done for Patterson. And ended up from doing 4 days shoot in Romania, I ended up out there for a month, and I was one of the leads like in the whole thing. So it was incredible.
But that is the amazing thing about this job. And I mean, on that, I mean, we talk about career defining moments and that, but you had an audition that would have been life-changing had you got the part, because I believe you auditioned for Anakin Skywalker.
Yes, you have done your research. Yes, indeed. So you've got the success of Braveheart had happened, and a couple of years had passed, and I was in school in religious education, believe it or not. You remember these things for some reason. Mr. Cartledge was doing one of his stupendous classes again, in religious education.
It's these key components of your stories that is going to make
it's
this
these
podcast.
Things that you remember, James, that really, really make you the person you are, isn't it? So you've got me and RE, and I get plucked out of the classroom again. The teacher says you need to go and chat to the head teacher, and it was my mum on the phone, and they said my mum had had a phone call from George Lucas, saying literally it was him. It wasn't his people. It was George Lucas on the phone. And they'd said, we need to see James in London.
I love it. Your mum gets Mel Gibson, and then she gets George Lucas. Like, you know, she's quite casual about it all at
it's,
that
it's
point.
It's top secret it was at the time. We didn't know what it was. And they said it's for... All they could say was it was for something to do with Star Wars. And this is when they hadn't made any of the prequels at all. It was only... the three in the 70s that they'd made. And we got flown down to London. I think it was at the Groucho Club. And my dad was really taken by that. He was like, oh, that's where the Beatles used to hang out back in the 60s. I didn't know what it was. Anyway, it was the meeting was there with George Lucas, and my mum was down again, and I went, and I was 12 years old by this point. And he was just chatting to me, and he says, I want to give you the whole kind of outline of what we're doing here. We're making three more movies that are a prequel to the other Star Wars, and then we're intending to do 9. And he'd got me to read certain lines in an English accent, well, as good as I could do at the time, an American accent, Scottish accent, because he said it doesn't really matter what his accent is. I'm sure he didn't want it to be thick Glaswegian, but because the only Darth Vader that we knew at that point had a mask on, so actually it could have any accent. It didn't need to be James Earl Jones's voice that comes out of a boy type thing. So I met him and we had chats, and he said he really liked me, and then And then later on, I didn't hear anything back. And then about 6 months to a year later, I got flown down again for a meeting. And it was, in that time, I was 13. I'd started to, I'd shaved my head at that point. I was starting to grow, tiny bits of bum fluff facial hair and all that kind of stuff. And I was growing up, basically. And when I met him that time, I could tell he was really disappointed. He was like, oh, he goes, you. And he said to me, he goes, you were the one we wanted. You were the one we really wanted for Anakin Skywalker, he says, but you're growing up too fast. And I went out and told my mum that, and she kept my feet in the ground, as she always does, and she was like, he probably says that to every lad that walks through the door, kind of forget about it type thing. And then I did, forgot about it, and I was working in an ice cream shop in Scotland when the film came out, and I was selling cans of Pepsi with this little lad's face on the side of them and stuff like that. Like, Jake Lloyd was the actor that got the part. And it just kind of went. And then the DVD came out, and I was kind of interested to see if there was any sort of kind of information how they cast Anakin. There was a little web documentary called 3000 Anakins, and it says the original idea for Anakin was this and that and that. And then storyboards for the original Anakin Skywalker came up, and it was me that the storyboards were based on, all of them. Like my face like a pod racing goggles on, and me with R2-D2 and lightsaber in my pocket and all that kind of stuff. And that was very cool, but also bittersweet, because I'm going, oh, he actually was serious when he said.
No, you're like, yeah. Goddamn bum fluff.
Growing up too fast, Jesus. But it was actually it was the only audition I ever went for after Braveheart until I went to drama school, because my mum and dad.
Geez, so you were basically like a couple of pubes away from being Anakin Skywalker.
Basically, yeah. Quote that. put that in the article. It was actually a kind of stark introduction to how the industry can be. How hard it is to. But it was a rejection, and it was fine. But it was a kind of introduction to maybe what to expect in the future, or what to be aware of how cutthroat it can be. Because up to that point, I'd been for one meeting, chatted to a guy for 15 minutes, and then I was in a film.
Yeah, your hit rate was quite good up to that point.
Yeah, right? All I'd felt at that point was positive stuff. And then I actually been having a kick in the teeth with the Star Wars thing was actually quite healthy, I would imagine.
This is it. And look, it's not as if you've not, like, things haven't happened for you and everything just fell apart after that. Like, you know, no. you've had a cracking career. Like you say, you've done it at the National Theatre. You've done Outlander. You're on the History Channel now with Washington. You've also done, obviously, the Scottish National Theatre, National Theatre Scotland. You did a role for that. Instead of me. But you've had a phenomenal career, without doubt. All right. It seems that is last order. So what that does on the podcast, the Performer Pint and a Pod, it means that we do some quick fire questions so that we can get a final round in. Okay, so here we go. You ready for this, Jamesy?
Ready. Here we go.
First up, what?
Yes.
Have you got a hidden talent?
Hidden talent? I've a demon on a pair of rollerblades, I'll have you know. The coolest things in town. I do like a little rollerblade.
Of course. Right. Next up. Guilty Next up. Pleasure.
Guilty pleasure. I mean, it's not a guilty pleasure. It's just a pleasure that I cannot live without. And it's ice. Ice. I love ice.
You do love it. You just eat ice, don't you?
I cannot. It's an obsession that I've had for what reason, I don't know, for how long. But yeah, I love eating ice.
Because you're a strange little man. Okay. Pet hates. What pet hates have you got?
Do you know what? I hate people tutting. I don't
really
people that tut.
All right, okay.
I don't hate the actual person, but in that moment, I will hate you if you tut. It's kind of like it's a disdain for something. It's like when you're walking, in London especially, the example I'll use is when you're walking and someone, you have that awkward dance where they go the right way, the same way you, and you go the other way, and it's like, oh, which way are we going to go so we can get past each other? And then if someone walks past and goes, oh, like that, in touch, as if it's my fault that they couldn't get past when we're both in the same boat, it really, really grinds my gears.
That's because it's rude, and it's always followed by an aggressive sigh. Sorry.
Yeah, and it's all that's insinuating that it's my fault, and I'll be like, "How dare you?"
Like, I'm not going to say it, but it's you. You're the dick in this situation. All right, here we go. Next one. Gut answer straight away. Favorite actor.
Favorite actor, Gary Oldman. Yeah, it's part of the reason I wanted to go to Rose Bruford because he went there.
What about me?
Oh, Graham Rooney, of course. Yeah,
bloody
a close
hell.
Second, Gary Oldman.
Tell you what, mate, you nearly got this whole podcast deleted there.
Did I not get the memo beforehand?
Right. Favourite actress?
Favourite actress, Kate Blanchett.
All right.
I love her.
Okay.
I actually saw her in a plane once, and I've got a rule that if I've not getting to say to someone, I'll go up to someone and chat to them if I feel like I've got, but I don't want to be like, hi, I love you, all that kind of stuff. Your work's amazing for no reason. Kate Blanchett was in the flight, and I spent the whole flight thinking what I might say to her, and then I never saw her again after it. So it was like, it's actually probably for the best, because I would have made a fool of myself.
Well, yeah, if you went up and said, hi, I love you, I think it would have.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be that. Well, yeah, that's probably what would have come out of my mouth, but it's not what I wanted to say.
All right, your idol growing up.
My dad. Yeah.
Oh, get.
Is that cheesy?
No. You wouldn't even cry. You wouldn't even cry when he was in the grave.
I'm like, come on, he's a fireman for crying out loud.
You were 10. You were 10.
That's not something to idolise. Idol growing up, when I was wee, like Superman. I love Superman. Just for real.
Your idol didn't actually exist.
No, I lived a lot in my imagination, Graham, which you can take from it what you will.
Nothing's changed there.
What should I say? Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela.
Don't just list people now, right?
No.
So we've got your dad, which is a lie because you didn't cry over him when you were 10, and now we've got Superman, who doesn't exist.
Yeah, let's stick with that.
Right, okay. Finally, what did you want to be? If you weren't an actor,
what I wanted to be, there was a point when I was younger, I wanted to be everything. I was like cartoonist, or I couldn't draw, so that was never going to happen. But the main one was, again, it's going to get boring now, but it was to be a fireman. I thought about it.
You're so desperately fighting for your dad's approval.
Yeah, no.
Oh, dear. Right. Well. James Robinson, thank you very much for coming on to A Performer, A Pint and a Pod. You've been absolutely superb. Remember that you can catch James on Washington on the History Channel. Is that right?
Yeah, History Channel. It airs in July. It's on Now TV over here as well. So,
well, absolutely superb, mate. Thank you very much once again for coming on. I hope that your dad listens to this and he will find out your true feelings.
I'm off to join the fire brigade. See ya.
See you, mate. There we go. That was a podcast with James Robinson, a man who travelled from Braveheart all the way to the National Theatre with a little sprinkle of Star Wars thrown in the middle. What a truly amazing career. I'll be meeting fantastic performers in the pub over the next few weeks and months with career-defining moments and secrets from behind the scenes. So make sure and don't miss out by subscribing to A Performer, A Pint and a Pod and follow at Performer Pint on socials. I've been your host, Graham Rooney. Thank you for listening. Please do rate and review. I'd love to hear your thoughts, unless, of course, you don't like me, then please do keep them to yourself. And remember, no one likes a stingy mate at the pub. So, share the pod with friends and family. See you next week.